Hello, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program is Climate Change in the Air. Our moderator tonight is Christy Dames. So I would like to welcome you all to the Business and Leadership Forum, who is sponsoring this program. And with that, I'm going to turn the program over to our moderator, Christy Dames, who is the CEO and co-founder of Tech Talk Studio. Please welcome her.
Thank you, Kevin. Welcome, everybody. Really, really glad that you're here for this program tonight on what's happening in our skies. So we're going to look and examine with some really incredible experts here with very different observations and understandings about things that are happening in the sky. And so we're going to explore that tonight to take a look at what's really going on in the skies. Are there things that we know about? Are there things that we don't know about? And so we're looking forward, I think, to a spirited discussion and evening. With that, I'm going to introduce each of our four speakers briefly, and then I'm going to go ahead and each person's going to give a couple-minute overview. Our first speaker tonight is going to be Mark Jacobson, and Mark is the director of the Atmospheric Energy Program and professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford University. He's also a courtesy professor of the Energy Resources Engineering, senior fellow of the Woods Institute for the Environment, and senior fellow of the Precourt Institute. His work relates to the development and application of numerical models to understand better the effects of energy systems and vehicles on climate and air pollution and the analysis of renewable energy resources. The next person is Alan Buckman. And Alan Buckman was a United States Air Force weather observer between 1960 and 1964. And he has served as wildlife field biologist with the California Department of Fish and Game for over 38 years. According to Buckman, research indicates cloud cover is part of a multipurpose weather modification program in conjunction with electromagnetic Tesla technology called HARP, and both identified as part of the United States Air Force Controlling the Weather by 2025 program as military weapons. Eric Carlstrom. Professor Carlstrom is a professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, where he teaches in climatology, geomorphology, and physical geography and human ecology. He's featured in national and international earth science journals, including Physical Geography, Geoarchaeology, Geological Society of America, and the Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences. And our fourth speaker is Rosalind Peterson. Rosalind is the president of the Agriculture Defense Coalition dedicated to protecting agricultural crop production from uncontrolled experimental weather modification programs and experimental geoengineering programs. She served as an agricultural technologist in California and worked for the USDA Farm Service Agency. Ms. Peterson was a keynote speaker at the United Nations DPI NGO Conference on Climate Change in 2007. Welcome, everybody, and I'm going to start first with Mark Jacobson.
Thank you, Christy. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the effects of aircraft on climate, but I want to introduce the subject by discussing recent historic climate and the historic climate record. Temperatures are increasing rapidly today. In fact, 9 out of 10 warmest years in the last 150 years are in the last decade, including 2010, which is the warmest year on record in the last 150 years. And if we compare this to the last 1,000 years, the rate of change of temperature today, well, is about 1.3 degrees Celsius per 100 years, which compares to the last 1,000 years of 0.05 degrees Celsius per 100 years. So the temperatures today, the rate of change of temperature today is much greater than any time since deglaciation from the last ice age, which was 11,000 years ago when temperatures increased rapidly following the last ice age. In fact, well, you can find warmer periods on record in the historic climate record over the last 4.6 billion years. In fact, at the beginning of the Earth, the Hadean period was named after hell, essentially because it was so hot and the Earth was molten. And in fact, 100 million years ago, there was no ice on the Earth. But the thing is that nobody lived back then. Today, we have 7 billion people, and we have agriculture, and we have societies that are trying to survive. And the rate of change of temperature today is faster than any time in the recent historic record. Now, if we look at some of the causes of global warming today, well, I want to distinguish between global warming and the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is the natural warming of the Earth's temperature due to greenhouse gases, which are primarily water vapor, which causes about 90% of the natural greenhouse effect, and carbon dioxide, which is most of the rest, but not everything. I mean, that is actually good, because if we didn't have these natural greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the temperature of the Earth would be far below freezing, and we wouldn't have any life. But global warming is the rise of temperature above and beyond that of the natural greenhouse effect due to human influence, especially emissions since the Industrial Revolution, starting with the steam engine. And the causes of global warming are primarily due to carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases, and black carbon, which is a particulate component from diesel exhaust and jet fuel and other types of burning. And so I just want to put in perspective that the warming that we see today, which is on the order compared to 150 years ago, is on the order of about 0.8 degrees or so Celsius. And that warming is due to a greenhouse gas warming, which is on the order of 2 degrees Celsius, much higher than actually observed, plus fossil fuel and biofuel soot warming, and fossil fuel and biofuel soot come from diesel exhaust and jet fuel, as I mentioned, and also biofuel soot is from home heating and cooking developing countries, particles that absorb sunlight and therefore appear black, and they heat the air directly. They're not like greenhouse gases. But those together, that warming is about 2.4 degrees Celsius, and less than 2.4 degrees Celsius. Half of that warming, more than half, is actually offset by other particles in the air, pollution particles, that actually they offset about half of it and cause some cooling. So the resulting net global warming is on the order of 0.8 degrees. So the scary thing about this is as we clean up the air pollution particles, which we want to do because they're the worst components of air pollution health problems, they kill about 2.5 to 3 million people per year worldwide prematurely, then we're going to unmask a lot of hidden global warming due to greenhouse gases, namely carbon dioxide. So this is the scary part. And so I want to illustrate just a couple other effects of climate change. Well, one is the Arctic ice. It's disappearing at a rapid pace. In fact, we expect the Arctic ice might completely disappear within the next 30 years or so, unless we have some rapid conversion of our energy system to eliminate emissions of greenhouse gases, but also fossil fuel soot and other components of warming. Another impact of global warming is air pollution, an enhancement of air pollution. As I mentioned, 2.5 to 3 million people die per year due to air pollution, but this is enhanced by another 20 or 30,000 per year due to higher temperatures from carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases and the particles, because the higher temperatures actually catalyze faster chemical reactions. There's also ocean acidification due to carbon dioxide dissolving in the oceans. There's a shifting of agriculture, and there's heat stress that will kill lots of people and already is killing people in places like sub-Saharan Africa where temperatures are already extremely warm. So what are the effects of aircraft on climate? Well, there are over 35 million commercial aircraft flights each year, and these cross the Atlantic, across the Pacific, they cross over the U.S., across over Asia, mostly in the Northern Hemisphere, but also in the Southern Hemisphere. And a lot of these flights cross the Arctic as well. In fact, I want to make one point here, is that the flights that do cross over the Arctic, they deposit emissions, literally they're the closest source of emissions to the Arctic itself. And one of the exhaust components of aircraft are particulate soot, which is the second leading cause of global warming after carbon dioxide. And this particulate soot is directly emitted over the Arctic and causes a warming of that Arctic region. In fact, there are different components of aircraft that cause warming. There are the contrails themselves, which form from the exhaust of aircraft, and they form from particles emitted by the aircraft and then water from the condensation from the aircraft exhaust going right onto these particles, plus water from the background air going onto these particles and then freezing to form ice. Those particles, those contrail particles, they act as a blanket, basically, in absorbing infrared radiation from the surface of the Earth. in sunny areas, they also can reflect some solar radiation, but their impact is more to absorb the infrared radiation. But there are also these black carbon soot particles that are emitted from the aircraft, and they directly absorb sunlight, and they affect clouds. They can actually reduce cloudiness because the clouds actually absorb that light, and then the black carbon absorbs the light from the clouds, and then the clouds heat up and they evaporate faster or melt faster. So, in fact, some of the warming over the Arctic, you actually get more warming over the Arctic from aircraft than you do from other latitudes. And just to point out, the relative contribution of all aircraft to global warming is on the order of 4 to 8%. So the net global warming of about 0.8 degrees Celsius, about 4 to 8% of that is due to aircraft, but there's a greater proportion of the warming over the Arctic due to the aircraft, and a lot of that's due to the flights that directly go over the Arctic. I want to end on a positive note here, say, well, how can we actually solve our problems related to climate and air pollution simultaneously? Well, we really need a conversion to a large-scale, clean, renewable energy system that involves what we call wind, water, and sun, wind power, the power and solar power, and geothermal, tidal, wave, hydroelectric power, and combined with electric vehicles and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles to some extent. And also all these clean, renewable energy sources applied not only to transportation and electricity, but also to heating and cooling, and even to aircraft, where we can even have probably far in the future, like liquefied hydrogen aircraft instead of jet fuel, and you'll eliminate all the black carbon as well as the carbon from that source. Thank you.
Thank you. Alan Buckman.
Ladies and gentlemen, I began actually as an observer with the Department of Fish and Game looking at plant death all across the North Bay area here. We were looking at the effects on dying chaparral, dying trees, the invasion of sudden oak death, which I think everybody here local knows about. I had my head down looking and trying to figure out, this was in the mid-90s when we were really looking at, okay, is climate change doing this? What is doing this? Because as I was looking at the vegetation, it really looked like it was getting burned. I mean, sunburned. I know everybody. The EPA changed the UV directory. You can go online and see what the daily ultraviolet is. The scale used to go to 10. They increased it now to 15, which is real interesting. I guess it's because it's just getting hotter and hotter, which is obvious. About 2002, I had a friend of mine hand me a video about chemtrails. Well, I didn't know anything about chemtrails. And he said, you were a weather observer in the Air Force. He said, would you give me an opinion? Well, I looked at the video. It didn't take me very long to figure out that this was a spraying program. Now, we did some of that in the Air Force. We mostly used silver iodide, which they still use for cloud creating clouds. But as I was looking at it, I really started watching not only what I saw in the pictures, but for myself. I've investigated this now for like 9 years. So I've been out watching. And what I've seen is, just to give you an idea, I basically call it the elephant in the sky. This is not jet exhaust, folks. And what I have here is a picture of a spray plane. And the spray is coming out along the entire wing edge, okay? And the more I looked, also found out they do big turnarounds. And what this is clouds with jets turning around. So they're flying patterns. What we end up with is sky. Now, this is a sky picture of almost total high, thin cirrus overcast. And track after track, they turn into clouds. These aren't normal contrails, ladies and gentlemen. The particles from the jet exhaust normally only extended a little ways. They disappeared rapidly. These are staying in the sky, and they're making clouds, okay? I went, well, gee, that's very interesting. I wonder what the heck they're using. Went to New York. I was also a presenter at the UN with Rosalind in 2007. On our flight to New York, there was a cloud haze cover from 35,000 feet to the ground the entire distance. I didn't think that was possible. How do you get a climate envelope like that? I thought, well, what are they spraying? It had to be some kind of solid particulate to stay in the air and make a cloud at 35,000 feet or higher. The water vapor is going to freeze if it's normal. So what is it? That led on to a lot of other observations. Also found out we were having water problems across the entire world, invasions of blue-green algae. In this case, actually, I did a treatment in Novato at West Bahia Pond, and there was a cyanotoxin there, neurotoxins producing sulfur. We treated it. We actually knocked it out of the water. But this is worldwide, so it's not just here. In looking at the spraying, it looks like, from what I saw, it was also in New York. It was all the way across the country. The dead plant impacts that I saw here in California, I saw across the entire United States and Canada in all my travels. Well, it all still looks like burn. Well, that posed a real interesting problem for me. If we have an overcast, and it's what all the scientists are running around saying, oh, we need a solar shield, hell, they've already got one, and it's still burning. So what's going on? That didn't make any sense at all to me. More investigation ran into HAARP. Well, actually, it ran into the Air Force first. As I was looking at the planes, just to give you an idea, and this is kind of typical, most of them are white, unmarked aircraft, again, flying grids and patterns. What I got my telescope out, and I was looking at them, mostly what I saw was KC-135, which are the Boeing 707 military air refueling tankers, and C-141s, which are the huge, big tankers, okay? Well, they fly in grid patterns. They're doing turnarounds. See 4 to 6 of them working at a time from my house in Calistoga. Variable cloud cover. Each one of the lines seems like it had different cloud, different cirrus in it. And I went, well, that's not possible in a normal front. That's very interesting. What is this? Then they're also flying in military airspace. Aha. Ran into the Air Force. We're going to control the weather. We're going to own the weather by 2025. Gee, how do you think they'd do that? I mean, that's a good question. Particulates. I got to thinking about, well, what are the particulates? Well, what's showing up? Air Force site was bragging about chaff. They spray millions of tons of chaff in the air every year. Well, chaff is aluminum-coated fiberglass. And they started out with really big hunks of aluminum. And I believe they've gone nano. I think nano, in order to stay in suspension, it has to be less than 7 microns in the air, which is a nano size. So I think it's nano, and I think it's metallic. When I started looking at all the different cloud types, I realized that had to all be different nuclei, which means they're probably different metals or metal salts. Metal salts are water-loving. It's the perfect thing to use. Alzheimer's disease. Ties into HAARP. We can talk more about that, please. I'd like to speak more about that, because with these conditions, all bets are off on planning on the weather.
Thank you, Alan. Next, I'd like to introduce Eric Carlstrom.
Yes, good evening. I teach physical geography at Cal State University Stanislaus and have taught for 30 years now. And I guess I'd like to begin with a quote from Michael Crichton, who spoke here 2003. The greatest challenge facing mankind is the challenge of distinguishing reality from fantasy, truth from propaganda. We must daily decide whether the threats we face are real, whether the solutions we are offered will do any good, whether the problems we're told exist are, in fact, real problems or non-problems. So what is happening in the sky? Well, a lot of weather modification programs have been ongoing, and right now NOAA lists 68 projects, 17 in California. These are by corporations for profit, also by individuals. They are unregulated at this time. Weather modification has an extensive history that goes back 7 or 8 decades. Mostly this is not well understood by people, but it's going on in 50 countries. There's scientific experiments going on, conducted by the government, corporations, the military, and individuals. For instance, Bill Gates has an experiment with climatologist Dr. Ken Caldera on cloud whitening, which, of course, would dim would be one of these solar radiation management projects using sea spray. And ongoing military operations, weather and environmental warfare, which is also got a long, distinguished history going back to Tesla technology, 100 years. This is the modern era of research efforts that span The past century includes federally funded research and development of Star Wars and Strategic Defense Initiative. Most projects like this are classified and therefore officially denied, and yet there are some 150 international treaties which prohibit weather warfare. Geoengineering would be the basket term, I guess, which would include all of these, including also the idea of terraforming the Earth's atmosphere and environment officially to mitigate anthropogenic global warming. Now, as a guy who studied paleoclimates for a long time, I pretty much insist that anthropogenic global warming is a, what do you call it, a red herring, a straw dog. It's not happening. If you look at the Earth's history, we are in a glacial period. It has been much warmer for most of the Earth's history without any tipping points. Carbon dioxide does not cause the temperature to go up. It's a response to changing temperature, not the cause. Carbon dioxide is a miracle gas, which is the basis of photosynthesis, if you remember your eighth grade biology. So there's just a lot of things wrong with the whole scenario of anthropogenic global warming, and yet that is used as a excuse that we have to fix the climate. One climatologist, Mark Nolan, says, I don't know what is more arrogant, to say that we have changed the climate or that we can fix it. The climate is an infinitely complex system, and we're still learning about it. And as someone who is a professional in that field, I think it's a very exciting time to be a scientist, but there's no way that we understand all the variables, so these computer models, these deterministic computer models cannot predict. Just like we can't predict more than 5 or 10 days what the weather's going to be because of the chaotic nature of climate. Well, we do have some major ongoing international programs that involve spraying in the sky. One thing you read is Project Cloverleaf, sometimes called the SHIELD Project, which seems to have been ongoing since 1994. This may be a global covert military project. It seems to be an effort to block or scatter incoming sunlight, solar radiation management. It involves military and commercial jets spraying of particulates into the atmosphere. Perhaps the atmosphere is being militarized, turned into an electrified plasma, in conjunction with HARP, the high-frequency active auroral research project, and GWEN, which is a surface source of directed energy, and perhaps also associated with scalar weapons. Here's a picture of this array of antennas up in Galcona, Alaska, called HARP. This has been online and operational since about 2000. It emits radio waves or extremely low frequencies into the atmosphere, into the ionosphere, where it can bounce down anywhere on the planet, can be used to steer hurricanes, the jet stream, and weather systems, and even generate earthquakes. These are using patents by Bernard Eastland, which is, he acknowledges, basically Tesla technology. ELFs are created at facilities like HARP, well, there's about 20 others in the world. And HARP can direct billions of watts of power anywhere around the globe. So these things are enormously powerful and can apparently create floods and drought and steer hurricanes, et cetera. I won't go into that too much. Anyway, there is extensive documentation for all of these activities, and you can read about them. But however, most citizens are unaware of them, just like most citizens are not looking up into the sky and looking at the trails and the grids and et cetera, the merging the spreading out of these persistent contrails, as Rosalind calls them. All of these projects are currently unregulated by Congress. Most citizens have not given had the opportunity to grant or deny their informed consent. And yet there's a long paper trail, including many international laws. As of 2010, the U.S. Congress and the U.K. House of Commons are proposing to collaborate and coordinate geoengineering activities. Perhaps they have already been doing that. We don't know. I'll just stop here. I know I don't want to take too much time, but there is a long documentary paper trail. In 1992, the National Academy of Sciences, top organization for the United States, published did a study, 918 pages, called Policy Implications of Greenhouse Warming, Mitigation, Adaptation, and the Science Bases. in which they recommend, quote, the most effective global warming mitigation would be a non-regulatory Manhattan Project involving the spraying of reflective aerosol compounds into the atmosphere using commercial, military, and private aircraft. This would create a global atmospheric shield, which would increase the planet's albedo, that's reflectivity, which would introduce ozone-generating chemicals into the atmosphere. Perhaps one of the surprises of this analysis is the relatively low cost at which some of the geoengineering options might be implemented. Well, these are natural clouds, cirrus, altocumulus, cumulus clouds. Many of you grew up with these. And, of course, now we have different-looking skies. We see these long, persistent contrails that widen. Even NASA, the Air Force, admits that these persisting contrails can last up to 23 hours instead of about a minute, the traditional contrails. And they can cover 4,000 square kilometers, and they can change the climate. And we see these things. Obviously, there is a systematic effort to spray. For those here, you can see these satellite images. So what is being added to the atmosphere? We will talk about that, I guess. Certainly aerosols, particulates, chemicals, and directed energy in the form of electromagnetic radiation from HAARP and other facilities. Again, Alan mentioned the document by the Air Force, 1996, Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. They lay out a timetable to introduce ionic mirrors, to use chemicals for atmospheric seeding by civilian as well as military aircraft, create smart clouds through nanotechnology, introduce carbon black soot. We have, again, lots. I did a lot of research for this, and I've learned a lot. I've got a 65-page document here I'd be glad to share with you. Let me just finish this.
Thank you.
It's called, you can pick it up afterwards, what I learned. And then I also have this 80-page letter, open letter to policymakers, colleagues, students, and citizens, disproofs of the hypothesis of anthropogenic global warming and proofs that AGW is a fraud. Of course, AGW is used to justify Plan A, which is massive reductions of carbon emissions, in other words, deindustrialize the industrial civilizations, and Plan B, geoengineering, the technical fix, which is playing God with the skies. So these are going to be available for anybody who wants them, plus a paper I wrote in 1992 about much warmer it was in the past, a million years, up in Glacier Park, where I've done my research.
Great. Thank you very much. Rosalind Peterson.
Yes. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's an honor and a privilege to be here with you today. One of the things I'd like to say is that we've been listening to conversations about what's happening in our skies. And what I want to say is that starting in 2002, I started investigating what was going on. I wanted to know why we didn't have our blue skies anymore. I wanted to know why we had man-made persistent contrails everywhere, jets flying in every direction over Mendocino County, and then as I traveled over other counties, and then I heard from people across the United States, these jets produce what NASA calls man-made clouds. They have done many studies, and there's studies all over the United States at universities and different areas, which talk about jets producing man-made clouds. They produce different types of man-made clouds, but these man-made clouds have some effects that we don't find with normal clouds. They create a blanket over us. So when you have a jet leave a persistent contrail, it doesn't say short and small for very long. It produces this cloud, long trail. It widens, turns into a haze or a cloud, and it traps heat underneath, and it shields the sunlight from reaching the Earth. And these clouds can be extremely thick. So what happens to the Earth when we start to reduce direct sunlight from reaching the Earth? One of the things that happens is we have a lack of photosynthesis, which means trees and plants can't grow properly. They don't gain enough energy from the sun. And so you impede their ability to produce crops. If you have for example, there's a corn crop study out of the University of Illinois which says that if you have increasing cloud cover, your crop production will drop. If you have normal rainfall and you have direct sunlight reaching your corn as it grows, you're going to have increased crop production. So as we have these man-made clouds, which can persist for up to 20 hours and cover 4,000 kilometers, according to NASA, what we're seeing is that, and that's just one, we have jets flying in every direction over Mendocino County, which has very little commercial traffic. We're not in the flight path in Mendocino County in Northern California. So therefore, what we're seeing and what has been identified even by a U.S. Air Force pilot who went to the U.S. Air Force Academy as being military. These military flights circle our county, and in 3 hours flat, they can turn our blue sky into white haze and man-made clouds. They can change our weather. According to NASA, man-made clouds change the weather. They can exacerbate global warming, like in the Arctic, for example, and they can negatively impact natural resources. These studies have been ongoing for some time. But what most of you don't know is that when you put up this cloud cover and you heat us at night, you're reducing the amount of what they call fruit set hours. And I worked for the United States Department of Agriculture for many years, and I was a crop loss adjuster. And when you reduce fruit set hours for apple trees, for example, and they don't have enough hours of freezing temperatures, then what happens is it doesn't set the crop for the following year. When it doesn't set the crop for the following year, you have reduced crop production. So without direct sunlight, you're impacting crop production. The other thing that you do when you reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the earth is your solar power panels are not going to work as well. You're going to have a reduction in power. So when we talk about clean energy, when we talk about alternatives, we talk about putting solar panels on our houses, we talk about having solar panels in the desert. When we produce these man-made clouds that cover our skies, what we're doing is we're reducing a way for us to have alternative energy sources. So this is becoming an ongoing problem, and they talk about it in terms of global dimming, where less sunlight is reaching the earth. Now, not only is it reaching the earth, according to various scientific studies, which I'm happy to share with anyone, but these particles that are released within the jet fuel itself also tend to warm us up and also tend to add to the global dimming problem along with other pollutants. So one of the things we need to realize is that the jets above us are having an effect. Now, many of you know that there's been talk and recent studies about the lack of vitamin D across the United States and that we're all having lower levels. The clouds that the jets produce that turn into these man-made clouds, cirrus clouds and haze, are reducing the amount of sunlight. And we now have, according to the CDC, the University of California at Berkeley, Kaiser Permanente, epidemic cases of rickets in our children, which is a lack of vitamin D, and they get the bone disease and their bones are weak. It happens to senior citizens now, as they're having more fractures. We're having pregnant women who don't get enough vitamin D, and this impacts their unborn children. The list is a long one from having a lack of vitamin D. Most people say, well, it's because we cover up, we stay indoors more. But I can tell you that, having taught tennis myself for many years as a professional, it would seem unlikely that I would have a lack of vitamin D, and yet the last time I went to the doctors, I was tested, and I'm short on vitamin D, even though this is something I do as a profession outdoors on a yearly basis. So what I'd like you to know is that when our government talks about geoengineering, and that means solar radiation management, they want to put particles like sulfur into the air to reduce the amount of direct sunlight reaching the earth. There's other chemicals, there's other gases that are proposed, and they want to do more of this reduction of direct sunlight. This is going to reduce solar panel production, the amount of vitamin D that we have, and we will have more health effects from that. It's going to reduce solar panel power production for all of us, and it's going to have other consequences as lower crop production and other issues. And with the jets, when they make this man-made cloud cover, the clouds are thicker, according to NASA studies. And when the clouds are thicker, it's much harder for heat to escape the Earth, and it's much, and even though it may be more reflective and reflect sunlight away, reducing the amount of sunlight, it's trapping heat inside as well. So we have warming effects from these man-made clouds. And with that, I will stop, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I'd like to remind our audience at home that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club program on climate change happening in our skies with our panelists, Mark Jacobson, Eric Carlstrom, Alan Buckman, and Rosalind Peterson. On that note, now, where we pick up this conversation with lots of information, I'd like to jump over to you, Mark, because we have lots of information here. We have what seems to be a non-intentional process happening that's happening normally in planes that are flying, and we have this potential, this intentional process that's happening. Can you help us make some sense of some of these different pieces?
Sure. So with regard to aircraft, there are things called contrail outbreaks where you get huge numbers of contrails in a large over a large area in a short period of time even. Or they could be persistent. The contrails could last over 10 hours or more. And these, I mean, but you can get these contrail outbreaks from commercial aircraft or military aircraft, and they don't even actually have to have anything special coming out of them. It's just regular pollution emissions. So we actually do this. We simulate the effects of aircraft. In fact, I do simulations of the effects of every single aircraft in the world. I have an emission inventory that has over 35 million flights per year, and we actually track the individual flight path of every single aircraft, every commercial aircraft that is, and there's another 10% military aircraft. And we can actually, and we have observations of the contrails over the entire U.S. From data from other people who have done work on that. And we can simulate those contrails and the formation of the contrails, and the predictions match the observations quite well, although there are going to be differences, some differences in some locations. But the point is that most of these contrail outbreaks are explainable. They are pollution. They are pollution from aircraft, from military and civilian aircraft, and they do have impacts on climate and weather. So everything that people have said here is correct about aircraft. They do influence our climate, our weather, and they have feedbacks to the climate as well.
I also had a question. You know, one of the interesting pieces here, as I was doing my research, was that over the last 10 years, so much of this has been bubbling up and has been, people are speaking about it, people are seeing it, people in Whole Foods parking lots are looking up, and you start to notice that there's some kind of global connection to this. But how come, why is this not a known, why is this not discussed, or why is this not part of the climate conversation that we're having globally?
Well, it is. It's starting to be. But you have to put the things in context as well. I mean, global warming is about 0.8 degrees Celsius, and the warming due to the aircraft are on the order of about 4 to 8% at the high end. And so it's becoming more and more well-known. As we do more research on it, because the problem was, I mean, it's so difficult to simulate every aircraft that we just didn't know all the numbers before. Mm-hmm. Now we are closer to knowing the numbers.
Yeah.
So that's one of the issues, is just having more knowledge by doing more research.
So we have climate impacts with ice, and we have the black soot that you're speaking about. But I'd like to talk a bit about crops. I mean, this is a multi-dimensional issue here. Now we're looking at health issues, food issues, all kinds of issues. So, Alan, I know that you had done some work in sudden oak death. And so what was getting your attention, and how did you start to make sense of what you were finding?
Well, when I was looking at the plant die-off, none of it made sense to me. It seemed like the weather patterns we were having shouldn't be producing this kind of an effect across the entire United States and Canada. And again, it looked like burning. basically everybody was saying, I took a lot of plant samples in, and what did they say? Well, they're insects or it's fungus. Okay. California, we had sudden oak death fungus, and as I traveled across the country, it was always some other fungus and some other insect. And I was really never too happy with that answer. Insects and fungus don't invade unless there's a lot of stress on the plants. I mean, a lot of stress. And you don't get the invasions of the algae, the blue-green algae, unless there's a lot of heat and a lot of stress. So in looking at that, that led me to, I think what really stuck in my mind was the trip to New York. And then subsequent flights across the country, the envelope was there the whole time. They've been doing this almost daily. Now, sometimes it's high and thin, and you don't really notice it, but it's there. They like to start out on the ocean, and they like to start in the beginning of a front, and it carries through, and it gets real thin. Sky's kind of gray. We actually had a couple days in February that I think I was almost looking at a real sky and real clouds. Seriously. The rest of the time, it's not, and it's a daily occurrence. Now, thinking about the flight to New York and having a haze bank across the entire United States, that means we're living in kind of a plasma envelope. It's cutting off free airflow. Well, things aren't normal. We really aren't Kansas anymore, folks. And we're all living in that. I wonder, the aluminum, is that part of the Alzheimer's? I've got a lot more questions than I have answers. Okay, I saw enough that have me, I'm really intrigued by the whole thing. I'm not real happy about it. I think we're all getting respiratory diseases and a lot of other problems.
So in other words, if plants are stressed and crops are stressed and microorganisms that need to not be in them are making their way in, they could potentially be making their way into us as well.
Absolutely.
And Eric, your understanding, your way into to see all this, and I know that you also mentioned HARP, and I mean, we know HARP exists, right? I mean, this is a factual piece of information. But again, I'd like to know how is this conversation slowly creeping into the mainstream, and does it need to go more into the mainstream? I mean, what needs to happen here to have this conversation part of the bigger climate conversation globally?
Well, there have been attempts to regulate and legislate this kind of activity. The 1977 United Nations ENMOD Treaty prohibited most of this activity. And in 2010, this last year, the UN Convention on Biodiversity prohibited it again. But these treaties don't have any teeth, obviously, because nobody has changed their behavior. And we've got 150 other laws around the world prohibiting this kind of activity. Yet it goes on. It's not regulated. It's not discussed. And to the extent that we don't pay attention, obviously it will continue. To the extent that citizens start looking up in the sky and asking what's going on is the government acting in our best interest, in someone else's best interest, these are the questions that we need to understand. We need to at least ask. And I'm coming from position of a physical geography professor who understands something about the history of the Earth, and I can say that 80% of the Earth's history, climate was significantly warmer than today, and there was virtually no ice on the planet. So don't get worried about global warming. Global warming is good. The medieval warm period was a period of wealth and longer growing seasons and longer lifespans, and to be afraid of warming is silly. To be afraid of cooling is at least intelligent. The Little Ice Age was a period of shorter growing seasons, more starvation, more disease, much harder lives, and that was quite recent. So we have examples. We know what these natural climate changes do to humans and other organisms. I think also you had Professor Robert Carter, who wrote Australian paleoclimatologist, speak here. He wrote a great book called Climate, the Counter Consensus, in which he outlines a sensible plan B, which is, given our knowledge of how climates change, let's prepare to adapt to them, as we always have. Our species has been around for 130,000 years. We came about basically in the last interglacial when climate was significantly warmer than now. Sea level was several meters higher than now. Nobody was driving SUVs, to my knowledge, 130,000 years ago. So people lack this basic understanding of the history of the Earth. And see, that's the problem. You know, take an earth science course, or at least have our congressman take an earth science course. I think we'd be better off.
And also, it was interesting in some of my research, too. I came across Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas, who I think a few years ago had put through multiple weather modification in the U.S. in the Congress in legislation. And I mean, I think many people don't realize that maybe weather modification is happening. And then in the research this last week, I also came across a company in Southern California who I have a screenshot of actually advertises for doing weather modification. I mean, on their advertisements, they do weather modification. And now, who are these people, Rosalind, so I have factual information, they exist, but who are they? What are they doing?
In the United States, right now, under federal law, anyone, any individual, any private corporation, any city, state, county, the military, government agency, university can modify your weather without your consent, without your knowledge. And they don't even have to notify agriculture producers that they're modifying the weather. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, lists 66 ongoing weather modification programs just in the western states. There's about 30 here just in the state of California. And today, if I had the money, I could take and hire a weather modification company to enhance snow, enhance rain, dissipate clouds. And we can use various methods, ground-based. You can use rockets. You can use small airplanes. You can use the jets, which we see, which modify our weather all the time when they leave the plumes. So there's all of this is going on. And in California, one of the things that we're having now is that one county, one city can modify the weather, and they can move the water that used to go to an agricultural producing area, like in the Central Valley. They can put more snow or more water into another area and deprive an area that usually has enough for agriculture from and put them into drought situations. There's Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, which mm-hmm. you raised, has each year wanted to put in a weather mitigation modification bill in which more and more people could mitigate or modify the weather without consent, without public knowledge. And the bill has had $10 million in funding written into it every year. We've been able to defeat it for the last 5 years through lobbying efforts. But what we need to do is make sure that nobody can modify our weather and change it without our consent. And this is one of the issues that I think is critical.
So I would like to ask our audience members that have any questions to please form a line over here at this microphone and to remind our audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club program on climate change happening in our skies with Mark Jacobson, Eric Carlstrom, Alan Buckman, and Rosalind Peterson. I'd like to talk a little bit about some solutions here about expanding this conversation, expanding things that we do. And Mark, I know that you were speaking to some solutions earlier. Given the complexity of this topic, can you help shed some light on things that would be most critical in the short term?
Well, I first have to clear the air that I think it is important we do address this issue. I mean, there are 55 to 70 meters of ice locked up, and so if we allow, you know, warming to continue forever, or not forever, but just for a long time, then a lot of coastlines will be flooded, and since we have 7 billion people on the Earth, that would affect a lot of people's lives. It'll also shift agriculture. It'll cause heat stress. A lot of people will die. The enhancement of air pollution due to higher temperatures alone is going to kill and already has been killing tens of thousands of people each year worldwide, just the enhancement due to the higher temperatures. The loss of citrus crops is a serious thing. And the death rates, I mean, certainly there are benefits to some places for warmer temperatures, but there are also disbenefits and significant disbenefits in terms of enhanced bacteria or in some cases or some types of viruses that persist. But it's really a a geoengineering approach to say, well, we should just let it just fly because it's happened 100 million years ago or a long time ago when people didn't exist. That was a different situation. The continents were aligned differently at that time. This is a different situation now. We have to persist with society. Now, on to solutions. The solutions, it's clear that we need to get away from combustion. And really, we need to go to electrification. Electrification is the key because it's so much more efficient than internal combustion. And just from vehicle point of view, it's about 4 to 5 times more efficient. You get more, 4 to 5 times more energy motion out of your car by using an electric car than an internal combustion car. You can power the entire world, 50% of the entire world for all purposes, with 3.8 million 5-megawatt wind turbines. You can power another 40% with solar, so that's 90% of the world with wind and solar. There are more wind and solar resources. They're on the order of 20 times more solar resources than you need for all energy for all purposes worldwide. In locations where the solar would be cost competitive, for wind it's on the order of 7 times more. You have plenty of that, and the rest could be geothermal, hydroelectric, tidal, and wave power. These are solutions that exist today. It's really, and this is without any nuclear power, without any biofuels, without any coal with carbon capture, just with pure, clean, renewable energy, a way to revitalize the economy, to save 2.5 to 3 million people's lives per year, and to eliminate all global warming, which has been on the order of 0.8 degrees since the 1800s.
Thank you. I know Saul Griffith, who spoke here recently, was talking about some of those very same things, that we can do this with everything that we currently have. Thank you. Okay, let's take first question.
Okay, being from Berkeley myself, I'd like to address my first question to Dr. Jacobson, and that's how I managed to win so many bets with my coworkers. And to say this, I have to explain, I work in a building where I'm on the 15th floor. We have a good view. I can see myself that when contrails are being laid down in a certain lattice pattern, that it will rain within 24 to 72 hours, and that that rain will usually be at night while the day will be clear. Conversely, if I don't see those contrails forming...
And excuse me, can you get to the question, please? We have about 15
right.
people lined up. Please.
And I know you don't want to hear the question. Conversely, if we don't see those contrails, it will be a clear day. Now, I don't presume today was a clear day, for example. I don't presume that the air traffic at SFO was halted. Could Dr. Jacobson explain to me why it rains after I see those contrail programs forming, but not on clear days when air traffic is normal?
Well, when you form contrails, the relative, what's called the relative humidity over ice is very high. So that means the air is very saturated with water at high altitudes where ice forms. And most rain that we get really starts as ice and comes down then and melts, and you get liquid rain. And so if you're getting, if that's what you're saying is true, and I can't verify it, but let's say it is, then what that would indicate is those are high relative humidity days, and it's more likely you'll get rain.
Really?
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Your question?
Is anybody doing the calculation of how much fuel is being burnt on this spraying project and whether there is a net gain or loss in the reduction of global warming, if that is ostensibly the reason for our own good why it's being done?
The military is the largest user of jet fuel in the United States, and the U.S. Air Force contributes most of that as part of their normal operations worldwide. So jet fuel used by the military, and there are calculations on the U.S. Air Force website talking about their jet fuel uses and that they're the major user of jet fuel above commercial airlines usage at this time.
This question is for Professor Jacobson again. Thank you for trying to share the science with us this afternoon. There were 2 points that I wanted to draw you out on a little further. One was the question of more local effects, other sources that are then having an effect. I know, for example, automobile pollution is now a significant contributor to crop failures and things of that nature because of the effects of particulates, and also just a lot of the stuff coming over from China's power plants wafting across the Pacific. And second, the question about geoengineering as a proposed solution, which is often being said is this much cheaper than actually reducing our carbon emissions, the potential consequences of just treating that symptom as opposed to the cause with ocean acidification and other effects of total addition to carbon that's messing up the ecosystem in other ways than just climate warming.
Yeah, so in the first question, I guess the question is really, what's the relative contribution of local pollution versus aircraft pollution on local pollution? And we actually did a specific study just looking at that. We looked at whether or not aircraft from cruise altitude, what it's called, up in high in the atmosphere, whether that can actually come down to the surface and impact surface air quality. And the conclusion was that it's really a small contribution. Stuff that from the airports itself is important, like emissions from the aircraft as the planes are taxiing and coming back, and also just the airport operations are important for local air pollution. But the high-altitude emissions are not really coming down, except in some locations where you have high pressure where the air descends. It just takes up there, high up in the atmosphere, it takes a long time for the air to descend in most places, in most parts of the world. However, near-surface emissions from aircraft are important for affecting local air quality. The effects of local emissions are overwhelmingly important. I mean, the cars on the street and power plants, those are causing, you know, I'd say 98% of the pollution. There is some contribution. I don't want to say there's not, especially when you're under the Pacific high pressure system where you have descending air, you will get some effects, some downward motion of those aircraft plumes, but it's not a lot. And so with regard to geoengineering, that's just masking the solution or problem, really. It's because geoengineering is just like adding sulfur to the stratosphere, for example. You're just increasing the reflectivity. Mm. So, okay, that might offset some warming for a little bit. There are side effects, but you're not actually then reducing the emissions, so your emissions just keep building up. And so when you stop adding the material to the stratosphere, then all of a sudden you're going to unmask huge amounts of warming, and your problem is going to be much worse than it was before. And there are all these side effects that we don't contemplate right now, but we kind of have an idea what they might be.
Thank you. Yes.
Hi. I'm sorry, but I just am confused. First of all, who's responsible for this geoengineering? Is it to reduce global warming? It seems yes and no. And how can we petition against it or vote against it if it's, you know, how can we stop it? And also, it seems nuclear power plants are extremely dangerous. How can we put a stop to those? I mean, what can we do? So who's responsible?
What are some next steps? Like, where do we go right now?
And I don't know what the purpose is. It seems to be to kill populations. I don't
I'd like to answer that. One of the things is the U.S. House Science and Technology Committee held three hearings on geoengineering, one in 2009 and two in 2010. They're working with the U.K. Parliament on global geoengineering governance. Most people did not know, and it was not covered on television. C-SPAN did not cover the hearings, not any of them. And most of the scientists that were there and participated in those meetings admitted that there would be health effects. They did admit that there would be acid rain, more chemicals introduced into the atmosphere. But the majority of them who testified, and there weren't anyone from agriculture, no one from any of the sciences, like to discuss acid rain on trees from these programs, most of the people there that testified at both the UK Parliament and the US House Science and Technology Committee were in favor of doing the experiments. One of the things that we have to realize is that our government is working on this with the UK Parliament, and it is time for us to step up and take action. And I'm going to let Alan wanted to address this issue as well.
First, I wanted to make a comment about contrails and chemtrails. I would like to know from someone here, contrails basically were short-formed ice crystals, normal exhaust. How is it that these are staying in the sky and forming clouds? And how is it, if they're not micron size, then how is that happening? That made no sense to me. The second is that we have a lot of other information that the particulates coming down are metallic. And I want to share with you a couple things. First, the California drinking water records. We got a hold of those, and we were kind of saying, has anything really changed in those? We found out, we had to write a computer program to figure out the data, which was very interesting, that in 1987, every drinking water, public drinking water supply in the state of California was contaminated with different metals. We had aluminum, barium, strontium, and a whole lot of other particulates that really aren't so wonderful. That didn't really get reported much. And then I want to share with you some alarming data. Now, this came out last year. These were samples taken off Mount Shasta. And the first one was the snow. And the normal drinking water, or the maximum that you can have in drinking water is like 50 micrograms per liter. Normal is about 0.5 micrograms per liter, okay? The aluminum sample was 61,000 micrograms per liter on snow samples. Now, these are real samples, okay? Well, where did all that come from? The second one was the forest soils. And know that Mr. Mangles, a Forest Service biologist, was taking pH samples. The historic soil pH was 5.5. It's now 6.8, and that's a 10-time multiple of forest pH. Now, if you know anything about growing trees and plants, that pH is significant, as same as it is with the crops. I started worrying about all of our plant communities. What's going on with the movement of our plant communities? What's going on with the movement of, and the changes in the wildlife? This is incredibly important to our own health. So I'll throw that out, too. But that's where I think that the particulate matter is being sprayed on us are metal particles, and those are not part of the normal air traffic. And so I don't know how you're going to compute those into your models if you don't know that.
If I could just interject, I've got a slide up here that talks about pertinent patents. And I think this might address the lady's question a little bit. 1975 U.S. Navy contrail generator patent. Powder contrail having maximum radiation scattering ability for a given weight of material. The seeding material consists of 85% metallic particles and 15% colloidal silica gel in order to produce a stable contrail that has a residence period of 1 up to 2 weeks. There's a whole series of these things. 1991 Hughes Aircraft Welsbach seeding patent contains 18 claims to reduce global warming through stratospheric seeding with aluminum oxide, thorium oxide, and refractory Welsbach material. It calls for using aluminum particles 10 to 100 micron size. There are many such patents. And personally, I don't think, to answer the lady's question, that this is related to our issue of man-caused global warming. I think there's military applications here, and global warming, man-caused global warming, serves as a useful cover story for why we have to fix the climate. The climate's not broken at all. We live in a very exceptionally mild and stable climate. The last 10,000 years has been the interglacial period when conditions were ripe for agriculture and for human civilization. If you go back the previous 10,000 years, you see radical temperature changes as we've come out of the last glaciation. So we got a great climate, and a little bit of warming, 1-2 degrees centigrade, would be fine. Now, if it starts to cool rapidly, then we might have a problem. But I think there are military things going on that are not related really to addressing man-caused global warming at all, but that serves as a cover story.
Thank you. We have time for two more questions, I believe, so please.
Okay, this fits right into what I was going to ask, having to do with colloidal aluminum and growing crops. It is my understanding that that's a well-known agricultural genetically modified organism creator is creating crops that will grow in aluminum-contaminated soil. Which came first, and who is profiting from all of this work?
Monsanto.
Did I hear Monsanto there?
Is one.
What I'd like to say about that is Monsanto and other genetically engineering companies who are playing with our seeds and our crops are trying to get aluminum plants to grow in aluminum soils. The other issue is that trees don't survive well in soils. We know from studies that once the aluminum gets into the tree roots, the very fine roots, that they can't absorb enough nutrients and water to grow healthy and strong. So there are some applications in that area which makes the trees look like they're dying of drought when in actuality they're kind of starving for the nutrients and the water that they need to grow. The other issue about geoengineering and putting up particles and chemicals is that in 2009, September 19, 2009, the United States Navy put up an aluminum oxide dust cloud over the entire eastern seaboard of the United States. And that Oceana group just came back from a five-year tour of all the oceans of the world. And at that time, they discovered that the main pollutant was aluminum. It shocked them. And when they had to do their graphing from the testing of whales in every ocean environment, what they discovered was they had to take the aluminum out of the graph because it skewed all of the other chemicals that they were testing for. So aluminum and our ability to do upper atmospheric testing, and right now we do, we put up barium using rockets. We put up barium, aluminum, strontium, trimethyl aluminum, and aluminum oxide into the atmosphere. These are NASA and U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force programs, and that these are online on the NASA website so that you can look and see exactly what they're putting up and the type of programs that they're doing. And the range and scope of these upper atmospheric programs floored me, as much as it would floor anybody who would be looking at this type of technology and the experiments we're doing in the upper atmosphere.
Thank you. Please.
Hi. I have a question, and maybe Rosalind could start with the answer. And it has to do with the HAARP program that you were talking about. Because before coming to this, I went online and I saw something about communication systems and HAARP, something about ionizing the atmosphere, and I don't quite understand that. And the other thing that I'm very concerned with is the illnesses that I'm seeing, the flus that go on all year round. When I was a kid, I'm nearly 60 years old, and when I was a kid, we saw flus in the winter, and now I see them all year round. I would like to know what this means, and maybe if you could touch on the whole thing about what's happening with the fungi. I'm a mushroom collector, and I'm seeing very different fungi in the soils. I'm seeing a loss of a lot of the really good edible ones, and I'm seeing a lot of the really poisonous ones now. Thank you very much.
I'm going to address the areas that are more in my area of expertise, and I can tell you that the bacteria and some of the things we're seeing in the soils are changing because of the type of chemicals that are coming down into our soils. I can also tell you that I'm not an expert on HAARP, so I'm going to defer on that subject because that's not my field of expertise at this time. There are others who know a lot more about that subject. The second issue is that the colds and the flu, on KGO Radio, Ron Owens had a gentleman who was in a flu pandemic, and a person that handled flu epidemics worldwide. And when Ron Owens on KGO asked him what the best disinfectant for flu and to stop viruses or a pandemic, he said direct sunlight. Ron Owens asked him three times, and three times this expert said direct sunlight. And if we don't have direct sunlight, what happens is your molds, your mildews, your funguses and other things grow and proliferate, and you're more likely to have flus and colds and other things because we're not getting the direct sunlight. And that was his expert opinion. And if anyone else would like to talk about the answer to that.
I only want to make a quick comment here. One is the envelope I was talking about. If it has metallic particles in it, it's a plasma envelope. And HAARP, and I had one here on Rich Garcia, the director of public relations for HAARP, basically said, we can do what the sun does. Okay? They're solar generators. They can bounce heat. In fact, they can create any frequency they want with it. They can match our biological frequencies. It's unlimited. One of the references, See Holes in Heaven, or I believe that the other one, The Angels Don't Play This Harp, I believe you showed already. So they can direct energy into this plasma envelope, and if you have a metallic cloud cover, you can bounce that, literally bounce those waves right back to any place on Earth. And HARP is a directional antenna. You can move it and you can bounce it in all kinds of places. I heard there was about 17, maybe there's 20 or more. Apparently they can be on ships, they can be almost anywhere to get these antennas going. So who knows? Who's creating what heat? So where is the heat coming from? It's a really good question. Where is it really coming from? I want to show you one real quick picture. This is a spiral tension field, and this was off the HARP antenna in Norway, and this was taken by tourists. Now, maybe a little hard to see, but it's a real interesting envelope. The other thing they're doing with it is they can create Tesla domes, and they can warp they're warping the atmosphere out, supposedly for missile protection. Well, I don't know what they're doing it for or how much they're doing. I just know they're doing it, and I know that we have some technologies here. I'm afraid I really don't trust our Air Force and our military. I'm sorry, but I don't. I don't believe what they're saying. So I see, what I see is, are a lot of problems, and I believe that we're one people, one Earth. We need to ban chemtrails, ban HARP as a weapon, and restore our natural environment, and that's where I'm coming from.
I'd like to thank all of our guests here today, Mark Jacobson, Eric Carlstrom, Alan Buckman, and Rosalind Peterson. All of our questioners, thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. And everybody will be sticking around for more Q&A afterwards. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank our moderator, Christy Dames. And my name is Kevin O'Malley. And with this, I would like to adjourn this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of public enlightened discussion.